regular and couple meetings are called to order. First thing we'll do is reset the supplemental meeting, and if we could start with a moment of silence, remembering there's people that aren't with us anymore. Thank you. The consent agenda, anything there you'd want to flag?
No, nothing unusual.
Okay. Well, the first thing we have are the minutes from the last meeting. Anyone have any questions about those? Okay. Can we have a motion to approve the June 2nd meeting minutes?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Detailed consent agenda. Can we have a motion to approve those? That?
Who?
Motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. I need to do a better job of instilling confidence to make perhaps there's some classes somewhere I can go to for that. I'll see. Okay. Public comment. We have one gentleman. You look like the public. Do you have a comment?
Thank you. Can I guess I'll just talk to you from here.
Yeah.
Okay. It won't take long. It's regarding the minutes of the meeting, but not this week. I was here on February 9th of this past year, and I addressed the board regarding my criminal complaint I filed with the Texas Ranger White Collar Crime Division regarding questionable accounting information submitted to the state of Texas during the 2017 legislative session. The video cut off. I know that we're having technical difficulties, Nick. You told me, you warned me about it. And when I played the video 2 weeks later, it cut off and I got the word fraud. Now, mind you, you've got 10,000 retirees that pay attention to these videos and to the minutes of the meeting as well, not to mention the citizens of the city of Dallas. And under the Texas Open Meetings Act, which was a clear violation or possibly a mistake on your part, I could overlook the, when I got cut off on the video, the fraud, but I can't overlook the fact that the minutes of the meeting were substituted by the minutes of last year's meeting, February 10th, 2021, when it said that speakers present, no one spoke. My name was not mentioned, Joseph Thompson, nor was my subject matter, Texas criminal investigation of white collar crime into the Dallas Police and Fire Pension Fund. I think that's kind of important. The members of this organization understand that and get that. So that's my grievance. I'd like to see if you can fix it or have to go to the Dallas County District Attorney's Office and file a criminal complaint, which I am well within my rights to do. So if you would go ahead and you're a hobbit man there, Nick. You've got character, principles, and integrity. I don't want to sound like Al Pacino, but you're missing something here, Al. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, the other thing I want to talk about before I leave, it's real about a minute. The recent Townsend lawsuit revealed an incredible amount of information that had been concealed from the pensioners, myself, and everybody else. And the five-year investigation I conducted personally into this board confirms that. And the bottom line, I'd like to call for an immediate disclosure of all the redacted information on that Townsend lawsuit regarding deceptive half-truths that were told to all of us, and possibly even call for the resignation of Josh Mound from information that came out of it based on performance evaluations he received after accusing all former board members of receiving the same thing during the questionable time frame of the Towns of Boston. And he's still here. I don't get that. And Kelly Nocek, for a multitude of reasons, accounting, deceptive accounting practices during the 2017 state legislative session, not to mention the returns that have come in here over the last couple of years with the Dallas Police and Fire Pension Fund in comparison to the Houston Police and Fire Pension Fund. That's all I got for now.
Okay.
But I'd like to have a meeting with my representative who's only got 2 months left. Nobody calls me and talks to me about this except law enforcement. I'm getting a little perturbed about this. So I'd like to have a conversation with my representative before he retires in September regarding these allegations.
Okay, can I clarify? Would you tell me, he said these are the February, what meeting minutes did you say you're...
When I was here the last time and you came up to me and we had this conversation about the equipment being faulty, and I understand that. The video, when I played it back, it cut me off when I got to the
wall. So you're talking about the May meeting?
The February 9th, 2022 meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
and I'd like to see if you can, I know you can't change the video, but I think you can change
the minutes of the meeting. So you're saying the minutes said that...
The minutes were substituted from last
year. But what did it say that you object to? I want to make sure I understand.
When you get to the very end, there's four pages of the minutes of the meeting. When you get to the very end, it says speakers present. No one was present to speak.
Okay.
Now, you know, I can't overlook that because...
No, that's a very, very, very legitimate...
Okay. And it's funny, when you go to all the other... monthly meetings, you don't see a substitution of last year.
It's an objective.
Right.
It's either correct or not correct. We will look at it right away. If it is there, we'll
and you're a habit, man. You've got integrity, and I know you'll do that, right?
Actually, more South Catholic, I think, about it. But we'll... Huh?
There are the minutes, and he's listed on the minutes.
Okay, Kelly, point, just if you'll...
Here's the date of the minutes. Oh, geez. February 10th, 2022, Joseph Thompson, present.
Okay. And did you comment? You're listed as present in the meeting minutes.
Do what now?
You are listed, Kelly just showed me, in the meeting minutes. You're listed.
On February 9th?
February 10th,
February 10th, okay. Was it posted on your website?
Yes, I just...
For the retirees?
She just looked at the website.
Okay. Well, you must have made that change since the last time I looked, and I've looked maybe three or four times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, that was a legitimate...
Now, I think the city council, maybe they made a phone call. I addressed the city council.
No, I just want to say that you made a good objective observation. We went and checked the source document.
Okay.
And then as it relates to your other comments, I just want to tell you that Kelly and Josh have our full support right now.
Oh, that's fine.
We listen respectfully to what you say.
Right.
You can mock my educational background all you want. That's cool. But they have our full support.
That's your educational...
No, I was kidding.
That's
no,
outstanding.
I was kidding.
I'm mocking your integrity, mister.
Okay.
I don't like being messed with, all right? I came here in good faith, and you did that. That was a deliberate ploy. Don't tell me it wasn't, okay? All right? Everything I've done has been, you know, met with resistance by this board constantly, all right? And I'm just a little upset about it.
All right,
we listened to, you
made a statement of objective fact.
Okay.
We looked at it.
And you're correcting it.
Well,
all right, and I'm done.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Always appreciate your comments. You bring a lot of energy. Appreciate
it.
Well,
I'd still like to talk to my representative when I get the chance, okay? And you know how to get my phone number, I'm pretty sure, for these records, okay? Thank you very
much. All right. Okay, so now we're going to go to...
I'm not sure if there's anyone on the phone that wants to speak.
Yeah, anyone else?
Anybody okay, on the call, press 5-star, we'll unmute you.
Hey, Melissa, unless it's noisy, will you leave those doors open? It's probably going to get hot in here.
I don't see anything.
Okay, great. Okay, we're going to move to item C1. The first thing, and I think we have Jeff and Kelly, or Jeff online by phone from Siegel, to talk about some of the assumptions and actuarial evaluation issues.
Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Yes. Can you all hear me clearly?
Yes. Is Caitlin joining us today, or is it you?
She's not. Okay.
Okay. Just by way of introduction, we have two items for Jeff today. One is, on an annual basis, we talk about the actuarial assumptions we use for the evaluation. He's got a presentation that you've seen before, and we've recently had that actuarial training. So Jeff's not going to go through the whole thing, but he's going to talk to you about assumptions he thinks we should consider changing. And then, based on prior conversations from the board, we also have talked to Jeff about the active duty survivor benefit issue. So with that, Jeff, you can take it away.
Okay, thank you. I do look forward at some point to be able to get back out there in person. But I think this can be a very brief discussion of the assumptions unless you have questions. If we could go through just a couple of pages, if we could fast forward a couple of pages in the presentation. Yeah, that one right there. Thank you. So really, this is the what I was planning to discuss, unless you have any further questions. We really don't have any recommendations for changes. There was an experience study performed, as you recall, you probably recall, for the five-year period, 15 through 19. Those were first implemented in the 2020 evaluation, and the next study is not due for another couple of years, which we anticipate we would reflect those assumption changes in our 2025 actuarial evaluation. There have been a couple of changes since the last study, which was the discount rate forward lowered last year from 7 to 6.5%. And the amortization methodology was updated consistent with updated funding policy. And each year, there's an ad hoc COLA assumption that the COLA is updated each year when it's the COLA is estimated to be paid at certain new funded percentage points in the future. So we update that every year. But really, the only changes we want to look at are we'll update the administrative expense assumption. It's been the current assumption is $8.5 million, but the last 3 years, I don't have fiscal 21 yet, but the 3 years ending fiscal 20, the admin expenses were more in the $5.8 to $6.5 million range. So I think the $8.5 million is probably a little high. We'll probably lower that once we get the assets and get a better feel for it. And then other than that, the COLA assumption will be updated. That's automatically updated each year. And I don't really see a need at this point to update any further assumptions. We don't really do deep dives. We look each year at the experience, what happened versus what was expected to happen for, you know, the major assumptions for your retirement, disability, death, and turnover. But, you know, barring any, you know, major changes in member behavior or updated tables or things of that nature, we don't generally update those between experience studies. It's just not enough time has passed, not enough experience has occurred for the changes to really be needed. So unless there's further questions on the assumptions or if you want to look at certain assumptions, you know, what they are, they're included here in the presentation, but I don't really see a need or have a recommendation to make any additional changes this year.
Is the ad hoc COLA, is that for salary increases of active employees versus benefits for retirees? If so, what is that assumption now? Can you point us to that?
The COLA assumption is a year. It's when it's projected to start being paid. Let me see what it is. Current, I think it's a couple pages further in the. I'm not sure if that one is listed, the ad hoc COLA one, because we update the year. I've got the valuation on one of my screens here. Let me pull it up real quick.
I thought it was a percent funding before it becomes.
It's the bottom page. Yeah, you have to be 70%
funded. Yeah, 70% funded, not a time frame.
There it is.
Projecting
will be 70% funded in October 2069. So that's when it would go
into. That's
so it really has material impact now.
Right. So, I mean, we do update that each year. With the next study, I mentioned this to Kelly, the next study will probably recommend leaving that assumption the same between experience studies just because it doesn't have a large impact on the results changing it each year, and it's just more administratively messy for us to do it. But we've been doing it. We'll continue doing it. But we'll look at that with the next experience study, whether we want to keep that static for a few years. But other than that, like I said, I don't see a need really to look a deep dive into any assumptions at this point.
I agree with Jeff. We had the admin expense assumption high because of litigation and just unknown things, and we just haven't needed it. So I agree with reducing that. And the only thing I can see really changing between now and the next experience study is the city is currently in the process of negotiating their next meet and confer. So maybe next year, not for this upcoming evaluation, but the next one, there might be new payroll assumptions. But other than that, I think I would agree with Jeff. I think the assumptions are reasonable.
So you all concur. Okay. So we need a motion on this. Direct Siegel to use these recommended assumptions in preparing the January 2022 actual evaluation for the regular plan, combined and supplemental plan.
So moved.
He appears.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, now, Jeff, you're going to talk about the active duty survivor benefit discussion?
Yes.
That is on the memo that we talked about in prior months on page 44.
On what?
44.
44?
Yeah.
Okay. So earlier this year, I know you discussed it. Yeah, we were asked to do a study looking at the pre-retirement death benefits for members in active service. So we ran the current death while in active service benefit is 50% of the accrued benefit or benefit based on 20 years of service. The proposal is to change that 50% to 100% for pre-retirement death benefit. And then we looked at it two ways. We applied the 100% to all active members, and then we also applied it just to those who passed while in the line of duty. And the current assumption, but on the next page, there's about the active duty in the line of duty active deaths are approximately 30% of the active deaths historically. It's not a large number of people, I mean, compared to the whole of the population. So what you see here, the numbers in the middle of the page, these are estimated 2022 numbers based on 2021 valuation year, projected forward. The column on the right, and it says in the text, those numbers are based on everybody who's an active member having access to the 100% pre-retirement death benefit. So even if everyone receives it, the liability increase is approximately $7 million, about $1 million on the normal cost. The funded ratio, item line six, on the actuarial value basis it drops 0.1%. On a market basis, it doesn't even change. It does project the year 100% funding a little bit further. But you can't put a lot of stock in a projection that goes out another 60-plus years. I mean, that's going to be a moving target each year. So there's not a large impact on the system. Actuarially, $7 million out of $5.2 billion is not a lot. Now, obviously, that is real money. It's not my money. But it's this is with every active participant being able to get 100% death benefit, and you have approximately 30% of the active deaths are in the line of duty. So if this is applied only to line of duty, it's not strictly an algebraic ratio, but it's close enough. The liability would probably be less than $2 million increase out of $5.2
billion. Right. So, and you'll all remember that Jeff, and we've talked about this, but the board in a prior meeting has said, we want to explore changing the going to the legislature and increasing the survivor benefit for line of duty deaths. But we were looking at other options for active deaths that are not line of duty deaths. And we talked to Jeff about what those options are. Could somebody elect 100% JNS before retirement, before draw, and what would that look like? We talked to Jeff about that, and I'm not sure if I'm interpreting your words correctly, but it seemed like it would cause more harm than good. But, Jeff, will you talk about that issue of why you might not want to have people elect the 100% JNS earlier in their career? Go ahead, team.
Okay. So, well, couple things. Wait, hold on. I just want to kind of block this out just to be sure, because I do know it was reissued or it was considered that we'd speak about it. But, again, is it, I'm being very specific, is it for active duty people who have died on active duty and that they were 50 or they were the retirement but they had not issued it for their survivor? And is it for people who were of retirement status and died not on active duty but died without having designated to their survivor. Is, I mean, there's delineation right there.
So
this, I'm sorry, go ahead.
What the legislation is that we contemplated only deals with active members.
Okay.
Once they're retired, it doesn't deal with them. And it's only line of duty, and it doesn't matter age or anything like that. It would cover any.
Okay, so that's what I was saying. So that's
any age, any amount of service.
It was just active. That's what I get.
Yes.
That it was active, but so it's just active in the line of duty.
Yes.
Okay, but I thought you said like not in the line of duty, like.
So we talked about if we go down to the legislature with just that piece.
Yeah.
What could we do? Is there an option that wouldn't be viewed as
It would be actuarially neutral.
That's
right.
Actuarially neutral.
I get what you're saying.
That we could structure where somebody that wasn't a line of duty death could opt into, and that's what we talked to Jeff about. And you know, I don't think Jeff thinks that makes a lot of sense. But Jeff, can you talk about why you might not want people to opt in earlier in your career?
Yeah, I mean, usually. And you have the death benefit is what it is, and then when a participant retires, they can choose the form of payment they want. And if there's a cost associated with that, you know, if they go from a 50% to 100% or things of that nature, then you can pay for that. But if an active participant, if you got someone new on the job who started at, 28, 30 years old, and you're going to make them choose a form of payment they're going to get when they retire, or just in case they die in the line of duty, a lot can happen between, obviously, when they start. I mean, your average, sorry, look at the valuation. The last valuation for the population as a whole, the average start, the average age at hire was close to 27, like 27.4. So asking someone who's 27 years old to choose a form of payment they'll receive when they retire, or whether they want to have this optional form of payment and a death benefit, and charging them for that right off the bat, I don't think makes a lot of sense. I mean, so much can happen. I mean, someone who's single at 27, I mean, they could, you know, get married, divorced, married again, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the 30 years they're going to work on the job. So I mean, most plans don't make participants choose their form of payment when they're hired for that reason, because you never know what your status is going to be when you retire.
But I didn't think that it was when they first came on. I thought when they became eligible.
Well, we're currently doing that. So if somebody joins DROP, they can elect 100% joint.
But what if they don't have DROP?
Well, then we don't have an ability for that at this point, because they haven't set their benefits.
So if they're eligible, do not have DROP, they cannot set their.
Right.
They get 50% then?
Yes, and they get 50%.
Right, okay.
Except for now we're considering in the line of duty that would be different.
Right.
And that's the only thing we're suggesting here, right? Is the line
right.
of duty?
Right,
yes, the board had made a decision in a prior meeting to just do line of duty and then asked us to explore if there's other ways we could that were actuarially neutral to deal with the non-line duty.
And we're concluding that there is not a way to do it, so.
Doesn't seem like it.
Do we know what standard with other police and fire pension?
We do know that, but I can't remember.
Well, so if you recall, we presented the other systems and what their benefit structures are for the death benefits, and when we did this, when we presented this letter from Jeff back in, I think it was May, and they're really kind of all over the board, and what the board needs to understand is the benefits, death benefits are, you can't, and Jeff can speak to this way better than I can, but I mean, death benefits, you can't look at them in a vacuum. You have to look at them as part of the whole sort of benefit structure. So to say that our death benefit is better than this system, but not as good as this system, isn't really a, it's not really an accurate or a good statement, because you have to look at the whole suite of benefits that's under a plan. Jeff, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, before you do, just let me give you an example. So I just answered your question not very accurately when I said, yes, they get 50%. But what they get is actually an enhanced 50%, because if you've got somebody that dies whether it's on duty or off duty. Let's say they've been on the department for 5 years and they pass away for whatever reason. Their benefits calculated as if they have 20 years and they have the highest multiplier, whether that's 3% or 2.5%, depending on kind of the situation they're in. So
it that's is a death on duty,
it's a little bit more enhanced. And that's the nuances that's really hard that Josh was talking about with the different plans and trying to make comparisons.
That's someone who dies in the line of duty.
No, that's anybody that dies while active duty. Line of duty or off duty. As long as you're an active employee and you die, you get 20 years, highest multiplier. Okay, Jeff, sorry.
No problem. And just, like I said, the numbers we're talking about are pretty small as far as the numbers that would ultimately impact. Thank goodness they're small. But going back to Josh's question, you look at the benefit package as a whole. I mean, there could be certain, if you're comparing against another police and fire plan, it could be, well, maybe they have 100% pre-retirement death benefit, but their multiplier is, you know, I don't know, 2%, or it's something less than yours. So, I mean, what would you rather have? The chance of active duty death is not nil. There's a chance, but it statistically it's very small numbers. There were thankfully only three that passed away during calendar 2020 on active duty. So you guys have prior for benefit earned prior to September 1, 2017, for those who began before March 2011, you know, multiplier is 3%, beginning September 2017 it's 2.5%. So would you rather have a 2% retirement multiplier and 100% pre-retirement death, or 50% pre-retirement death and a 3% or 2.5. I mean, it's a mix and match. It's not, you can compare each provision separately and say, yes, this is better than this, or this is more generous than this. But I think it's helpful to look at the benefit package as a whole.
The other thing I would note is after we talked about this in May, Kelly and I talked to the people at Hilco about what this would look like and the potential of getting legislation passed in Austin. And I think they, while obviously no guarantees about getting anything done in Austin in a particular session, they thought, they were optimistic that a line of duty death, even though it raises the unfunded by a very small amount, would, you know, they thought that would be, they'd be pretty confident of getting that through, but given our funding status, anything other than that, that was not actually neutral, might be more difficult and problematic and opens up other issues. So we had, if you recall, we'd kind of gone down that road to just make sure that this would make sense to get through because it requires a plan change down in Austin in 2023. So
we're focused strictly on line of duty. We're talking about adding $2 million worth of liability.
Yeah, so, and that would be considered actuarially neutral, no?
No, that would cost us a little bit of money, but that's for a line of duty only.
Right.
We wouldn't be doing it for
right.
Not in line.
I'm sorry. I don't know if it's worth considering, but this would not increase the amount the city is paying because they're paying a set rate. It does impact the liability very slightly. It may or may not impact the funded percentage, but the actual what's being contributed by the city would not change.
Well, barring ultimately any, it does. I mean, if you're adding more liabilities, I'll be at $2 million. Ultimately, they got to fund that over some period of time.
True.
If the formula changes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So did this all get stirred because of death, because of COVID? I mean,
no. It came up because of an unfortunate situation that
Hey, Kelly, I might be able to add some color to that very generically if you'd like.
Huh?
Armando's the one of us.
It's Armando. I can add some color to that very generically if you'd like.
Sure.
So, Tina, to answer your question, we had a member in the fire department that passed away unexpectedly, was not of retirement age. He was in active duty. And that's when this situation was brought to our attention, and we started looking into it. And the member's wife came and spoke at a meeting. And as details started to become more relevant or more apparent, we felt like this was a topic that we needed to address as a board and as a system. So that's how all of this started.
Armando,
we didn't realize,
I recall, this person was off duty, though.
Correct. He was off duty, active duty member, but off duty. And that started
and
the conversation.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay.
So are you all looking for direction as it relates to trying to make this, advocate for this legislative change? What do you think?
I think it would be good to have, well, I think it would be good. I think we didn't get, I think we didn't quite get it. I think it would be good for us to just have board direction. It doesn't even be a motion, direction to pursue legislation to affect the in the line of duty death change.
Does anyone not feel positive about that? Does anyone have an objection to pursuing that path?
Nick, I do not, and I would like to make the motion to move forward with that.
Okay, Josh is not suggesting. Would you?
We can have a motion if you like. I mean, a motion, that's fine.
Okay.
I would like for it to be a motion.
Okay. Josh, why don't you read what the motion would be so everyone can hear it. Armando, he's going to say something, right?
So I think the motion would be direct staff to pursue a legislative change to provide for 100% death benefits in the case of a line of duty death.
Right. Armando, do you concur with that?
I do, yes. Thank you.
Okay.
And this is Ken. This is Ken. I'll second Mondo's motion.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries.
Thank you, Jeff.
Kelly, you talk about elections.
Yeah,
we don't hear much about those these days. So.
These ones are much easier. So on page 49 of your packet are the election results, and first I'd like to introduce Nancy Rocha sitting over here. Nancy is currently on our IAC, and will beginning September 1st, will be a brand new trustee. So Nancy and Anthony Scavuzzo and Marcus Smith. Marcus Smith actually currently works with Gilbert Garcia. They will be joining the board effective September 1st in the non-member position, taking Tina Gilbert and Rob's position.
I'm sure you provided it. Do we have the bios here, just so we know?
I think you can send them here, but we can certainly send them to you.
Sure. It's on the website.
Okay. No, Nancy. Marcus works at...
Marcus joined me about a year ago. It's coincidental. I've known him for 25 years. He's been on the Metro Pension Board for about 8 years. So my hunch is, I haven't talked to him about it. My hunch is he'll now resign from the Metro Pension Board to serve in Houston.
And then Anthony Scavuzzo, what's just his general background?
He's a private equity person. He's expressed interest in being on the board since the very first election and has stayed in touch with us.
Okay.
Marcus has been in private equity space for about a decade.
Right. So one other thing I'd like to point out, and I thought it was interesting, is the turnout by member type. We had 777 people vote. 4% of the eligible active members voted, and 14.65% of the retirees voted. It's funny to me a little bit of how many people still use their phone to vote. I always think, can we eliminate that cost in the election? But clearly, people like to use their phones to vote. The only other thing is I would like to thank Melissa. She really handled the election stuff for me while I was out with Josh in the courthouse, so I really appreciate you doing all of that, Melissa. You did a great job.
It's really a poor turnout of voting, though, isn't it?
Not great. Any questions on this or anything? Okay.
Well, we're going to have a lot of terms ending this year, and so we're going to have to deal with all that and engage with the mayor's office on.
I had a good, productive conversation with Tristan Holman this week, about that, and he should be reaching out to some of your people that are appointed by the mayor to see if you want to continue, can continue, and appointing some other people. So that seems to be moving along.
So that would be Mark and Alan.
Well, we have Alan's position.
Yeah, he went to veteran, yeah.
Mark and Steve are holdovers. Michael's position ends at the end of August. Bill's ends at the end of August. So,
Nick. Mine ends in August.
Right, well, yes.
The three of us ended in August. So you're saying right here this is ending in August and those two are ending in August as well?
Yes, the only three trustees that technically have terms that extend past August of 22 are Nick, Armando, and Ken. Yeah, everybody else's term is either up or they're already up and serving in holdovers.
And so, Bill, are you going to be? Or
I don't know what. I don't know what the mayor's decision is. Whether he's going to ask, I only could serve one more term, one more year anyway. 6 years is the max, and we're 5 years into it now. So I don't know what his plan is.
So you would be done anyway next year this time. Okay.
So it probably makes sense to bring people on sooner than later to have some continuity going forward, I would think.
Michael, I thought you were here longer.
Yeah, so I was contacted again, and I said I'd be happy to.
Okay, that's what I thought. I thought it was you, and okay. All right. No. I think it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
I think it's going to be okay. And, Nick, let's be clear. You're going to be here for another three?
I think I have one more year, although I think there's some. We don't have total clarity because I think I was off for a very short period of time, but then I just don't.
Right. The city is going to have to decide how they view that.
Yeah.
And Tristan's aware of that.
I'm confident it'll be positive.
I do need a motion to certify the election results before we go to the next panel.
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
And then we'll have to talk about the U.S. Advisory Committee, too, then.
Yes. I think that we have someone mildly competent in the interim.
And we're in good shape. I just want to make sure we need.
We may, we obviously want to find staff that in for a more longer term. Yeah. Yeah. And thrilled that Nancy's continuity. But it's you and Ken right now, right?
And Michael.
And Michael, okay. Okay, so you're staying. Okay.
Right. I mean, it'll be in good hands. Just gotta
figure
it out.
Okay. All right, there should be some humor around certifying election results. I couldn't think of what it is. But okay, Kelly, monthly contribution report.
Okay, on page 51 is the monthly contribution report. This is the July report with May data. There's nothing that it doesn't follow the trend that you've seen for the last 2 years. So I don't need to go over it unless you have any questions. I'm happy to move on.
We're the sub special additional thing ends this year, right?
Yes,
yeah.
It does. So the floor ends.
Yeah, the floor. This is $7 million.
The contributions will go down from $6,043,000 per pay period to $5.8 million. So essentially, no floor anymore.
They're still pretty far under the hiring plan, aren't they?
The hiring plan, they're actually over.
The contribution with the number of people were 195 below in May.
Right. So we could, if they hadn't given the raises that they've done in the last few years, we would really be in trouble.
Yeah.
But luckily, they did that.
A lot of things going on in the economy right now. So.
Right.
Okay. Trustee education and travel.
On page 57 is a list of some of the classes that we've put here, and Ken Haven has requested to go to the ANSIPRS Public Safety Conference in October, which is in Nashville. So I would need a motion to approve that if you want to do that.
Sure. We have a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay. Brenda, you can talk to us about the financial audit.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. The financial audit of the pension system is well underway. The initial field work has been completed by BDO, our outside auditors. That was done remotely again this year. We have completed 86% of the initial PBC list that was sent by BDO. Our primary outstanding items relate to outstanding investments, and then the actuary work, and then some final confirmations. Our largest outstanding items remain a couple of large audited financials from our investments, Huff and Lone Star, our perennial favorites there in that category. Once we did receive communication from Huff indicating that they would have their audited financials available in July, but we have not yet seen anything, as well as some additional information on the Huff Energy Fund that they thinks they have a selling process. So we will remain hopeful that they will actually get the financials to us in July. Historically, that has been more like October.
Do we have a sense of where the valuations are, Ryan?
I mean knowing Huff and where energy prices were at year-end compared, I think we did a back envelope a couple months ago, but I think we're carrying it at 67. I assume it'll be quite a bit higher. I think we estimated, closer to 100, I believe, based on just kind of future curve. And then I don't know if they actually do have a sale, the buyer lined up, I don't know how the price of that should affect, their year-end value. So we're going to have two data points that hopefully come in pretty quickly here to help us out with Huff.
Lone Star, where are they in terms of getting us something? What do we expect from them?
They have not issued the CRA audit, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that, and we're going to talk more about Lone Star a little bit later.
Okay.
And go into more detail then.
So once we do receive the final financial information that we need, we will submit the information to the actuary, and upon receipt of that final information, it'll be about 60 days. Takes the actuary about 30 days to do their work, and then a remaining 30 days for BDO to review the work and do the final touches to the financials. The staff here is already doing what we can for the audited financials, as well as the annual comprehensive financial report, working ahead, completing the pieces that can be completed, so we will be in as good a position as possible when those final reports to come in to push them through as quickly as possible. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Melissa, I hope you're thinking about what your idea is going to be for this year's annual report, the theme. You knocked out the park last year. Yeah. Okay.
And do you have any suggestions on that?
Okay, Ryan.
All right. Thank you, Nick.
Portfolio update.
start with a portfolio update, and then we have update on the IAC, EM debt search, and then we have Hancock here today to review the ag portfolio. And then we have private asset cash flows after that. So quite a bit to go through. On the portfolio update, I'll start with liquidation of the private market assets. We have $45 million received year to date as of earlier this week, and we actually got $20 million in July, in the first week of July. So talk a little bit more about where that came from. We have about another $15 million lined up that I think will come out in the next few months. As a reminder, on the safety reserve in March, we notified you guys we'd draw that down to pay benefit outflows, and we're going to talk a little bit more in the portfolio update about what the plan is there, where we sit at. But with the $20 million that came back this week, we're back actually back up to and a little bit above target there. EM debt search, we interviewed, IAC interviewed MetLife and TCW yesterday, and we'll get into the recommendation here in a minute. Reminder on rebalancing actions, we took it late May into June. We funded $40 million to the new international small cap manager, Global Alpha, and that came from the passive equity account. We redeemed $5 million from bank loans and put that into equity. They were a little bit over target, and then we equally weighted the four active global managers. Estimated year-to-date returns as of June 30 for the overall portfolio is about down 11.5% and then down 17.3% for the public markets portion. So looking at the bridge chart, we ended Q2 at about $1.708 billion in NAV. You can see here $55 million decrease due to benefit outflows, representing the $9.5 million a month, and then $228 million in investment loss. Pretty much all of that's coming from the public portfolio, just given the timing of private marks so far. I'm going to move around here a little bit, but this is looking at the equity markets. Drawdown off high year to date. You can see U.S., international, EM are down about 19 to 22% off highs, and then tech has been hit harder with NASDAQ down 28% off highs. This is a chart that I think was in Leo's presentation at the June board meeting, but it's showing correlations between U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds, rolling two-year correlations. And with rates going up, bonds going down, and stocks also going down, it's spiked and gone positive kind of end of 2021 and into 2022. So, I'm going to skip ahead to our performance and then get back to a few more market slides. This is looking at our public markets performance, month-to-date, year-to-date, 3 years. A few things to point out here. I said we're down 17.3% on the public portfolio year-to-date. In June, 5 out of 7 public equity managers outperformed their benchmark. You see Boston Partners, who has been holding up pretty well this year, a value manager was below the benchmark in June. That was mainly driven by energy exposure, so that helped them out a lot the first 5 months and turned on them a bit in June. Looking at the year-to-date column, you can see there was Invesco down 30 and Eastern Shore U.S. Small Cap down 27. Those are the areas that have been hit the hardest in the portfolio. And then RBC, our EM manager, is outperforming by 300 basis points, so pulling up pretty good against the EM benchmark. And then the outperformance in fixed income, we're down 11 versus a benchmark down 14. Which is quite a bit for fixed income, but we're outperforming by 3.3% there, and that's pretty much all the shorter duration within our fixed income portfolio compared to that benchmark. Any questions on the public manager performance? Okay. So going back here, this is showing, the next few slides are all based on U.S. S&P 500, but I think good market context. Our peak drawdown this year is down 24%. In the S&P, that compares to average inter-year drops 14%. Despite that, stock market's been up 32 of the last 42 years and only been down in 2 of the last 14 years. So, this next slide is showing in Q2 was the 16th worst quarter for the S&P 500 since 1926, down 16.1%. And what we're showing here is go forward 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year returns after a large drawdown in the S&P 500. And what we're showing here is typically, you know, the 1920s and 30s are a bit of an exception, but the go forward returns after a big drawdown look pretty favorably. favorable. So 1 year average of 18.6 up, 3 year average of 11, about 12% up. So almost always a good entry point into the stock market after a big drawdown. And as a reminder, we are currently have 40% in global equity compared to a target of 55. So as money comes back from the private market portfolio, if that's where we need to add the most money is into public equity, about $250 million, at some point here over the next few years. And, given we need to add a lot of money to that, we talked yesterday at the IAC about when do we start redeploying money back into the public portfolio. When we had talked to them in March, the plan then was we want to use private asset proceeds to refill the safe reserve back to the 18-month, back to the 9% target as it comes back. At this point, we're down, in bear market territory in the stock market. With the proceeds we just got earlier this month, we're back up to target. We'll go to the safety reserve slide now. So with that, it moves. Basically, currently we have enough in the safety reserve to pay benefits through December of 2023.
Where is that chart here?
It's on 68 of diligence.
Okay, got it.
So we're a little bit above target on percentage-wise in the safety reserve. The recent proceeds have moved that date of how much we have in runway from July of 23 to December. So regardless of what we do, we should have enough money in cash and short-term bonds to pay all the benefit outflows through the end of 2023. Given that and given where prices are in the stock market, the discussion yesterday was around using private proceeds as they come in from this point forward to redeploy into global equity. To this point, we've been holding them back in cash. We think it's a good time. I don't know when the next, it'll probably be a month or so before new proceeds come in, but as they come in, putting those to work in public equity. So it's a little bit of a change from what we talked about in March, but we think it's prudent. I think with the safety reserve, it's something we always have to constantly evaluate, and what we are doing now might be different than what we want to do 12 months from now. So we're always going to be looking at go-forward projections, what we think is coming in, what the level of the safety reserve is, and with rebalancing recommendations, what we've been doing since we've gotten into this drawdown mode on the safety reserve is typically it just requires Kelly and Makita to do a rebalancing, but we've been keeping the IAC in the loop and sending them a memo ahead of time saying, here's what we plan to do, here's what's coming in, here's where we want to put it, and just give the IAC a chance to chime in and give us some input before we make any moves. So
you're saying going forward, you're going to put it into the longer-term investment portfolio?
Correct. And we're not going to draw down the safety reserve to put it into equity, but when proceeds come in, they will go into public equity now as opposed to going staying in cash.
Yeah. And we're underweight that sector by
15%, 250%.
Public equities? Right. So that's why it's just perfect time.
At some point we're going to put money in. If we continue to just hold money back, I think the entry point here, who knows what's going to happen in the short term. It's a better entry point than we could be looking at if we have to wait until we get out of drawdown mode to start redeploying.
Okay, so if we roll forward 6 or 9 months and we're below our target in safety reserve, we would still put proceeds into the long-term portfolio or revisit or what?
I think it'll be continually revisiting it.
Okay.
But right now we would put it into the, we'd put it into the public portfolio. But if we get to the point where we're in mid-23 and we have 6 months left and we put a lot of money to work already, that's why I think it's got to be dynamic. And it's going to be a conversation every time.
I thought reserve always took priority, to assure that there's an 18-month
The reason we have 18 months is so we can allow it to draw down for 18 months and pay benefits. So the policy is a bit vague on it talks about
going
paying benefits out of it and drawing it down for that reason, but it doesn't specifically say what to do, how to reallocate private asset proceeds. So that's why we've had more discussion around that, since it's not really it's vague in policy.
Not clear.
And I think what we're doing now is right. It should be reviewed every quarter. It should be reviewed with both the IAC and the full board, and then make a determination as to where they're going.
Right.
And the IAC is watching it closely, so if between here and there, if there's new information, it'll be coming forward with recommendations to the board.
A especially in these markets. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to do like we did here, is just say, you know, if we took actions, IFP will be in the loop, and then we'll say, here's what we did last month. Here's what we did last quarter. And then we have an agenda item for the September IFP to talk about. As we put money into global equity, how do we want to redeploy it? Do we want to fill up small cap first? Do we want to go to active first? Do we want to do it pro rata? So, any other questions or discussion there? Okay. Thank you. Covered most of these. This is showing the detail on global equity, and here you can see we're at 695 in global equity compared to the target of 950, so about 250 million underweight, and then we took that action to roughly equal weight the four equity managers last month.
Okay, so we have Leo here talking part of the discussion of the manager selection, but Leo, do you have any comments just on things overall, what other clients are doing, anything you'd want to flag or have us think about?
I think staff has put together a good overview. We went over it with the investment advisory committee. It was fully supportive in terms of all of the action items that have been taken and that have been considered. Everything was unanimous. I think if I look broadly at, you know, clients and other, you know, peers of you, it's been the past 6 months. Most have some level of cushion from double-digit gains in four of the past 5 years, of which this, unfortunately, didn't participate as much. But one thing that we discussed yesterday, taking a longer-term view, is that a lot of positive changes have taken place for the past 5 years. Still work to be done, and that's why for staff, Nikita, and the board, the highest priority continues to be winding down those legacy positions. Overall, I don't know if it's a misnomer or what, but that whole concept that stock and bonds are always negatively correlated is not the case. If an increase in interest rates is what drives down the stock market, they're going to be positively correlated. If declining interest rates help the stock market, like it happened in the 90s, you're going to see a positive correlation. So bonds do help, but it's not going to be always, they're not always going to provide that defense. So, you know, at some point in time in the future, we might want to look at how we can have a more risk mitigating category within our portfolio. But I think that's going to take place once we put behind us the legacy private market position.
So given the Fed's going to continue tightening, how much risk is there in the bond market, do you think? And maybe Gilbert could give us his view, too.
From what we looked at, in most cases, the worst of the heat is in the first 6 or so months, even before usually there's some type of announcement or expectation of rates going up. So I want to think that the worst is behind us, although there may be still some declines, but we hope they're not going to be double. What is your take?
Well, for the first time in probably 3 years, I've gone long.
The Texas bond king has gone
long. I've gone long. I think inflation is either peaked or peaking. I think these last numbers, last move is going to almost seal the fate of a recession. It's a function of how shallow or deep. And I think rates are then peaking and will be returning to not all the lows, but I think we'll be coming back soon. And I mean, the yield curve will steepen. I think they'll start pricing out some of the Fed hikes, and the short end will do really well from here.
So we've done some analysis similar to the one your staff put together in terms of the worst quarterly returns and what happens subsequently, and we've done something similar in the bond markets with these changes in interest rates, and in almost all cases, again, it turns out that it's a good time to invest in bonds. What you're saying makes sense.
And I mean, in bond portfolio over the last month and a half, you know, investment grade and high yield were down the same amount a month ago. And now you can see high yield down 15 and investment grade down 10. So it's starting to hit credit more than just the duration in the core fixed income.
Okay.
So one more. So after that statement and discussion, do you support the additional distributions going into public equity long term?
Yes, we discussed that at the IEC and everyone, staff, committee members, Nikita, we were all in support.
Just curious, so I saw the other day that CalPERS did a huge sale of secondary private equity interests, and then kind of my sense is that pensions and endowments are going more into alternatives from an asset allocation, so those seem to be somewhat contradictory. And then I just would point out that people think that alternatives are a safe place. A lot of that safety is just a function of how they report.
Right.
So, like, for instance, you know, valuations for privately held tech companies are down 50 to, you know, close to 100% in 6-9 months, but you don't see that in a lot of the reporting, whereas if you have, you know, a growth equity manager, you might be down 30% at that right now and thinking, oh, alternatives are a place to hide, but they just haven't reported, or they, you know, they have more subjective reporting criteria in how they do things than an actual market price. So are you seeing more allocation alternatives, less, mixed results, different types of alternatives?
Yeah. So alternatives is a very broad word that means a lot of things. It could be, you know, anything from hedge funds to illiquid assets. Up until now, there's been no or very limited slowdown. It continues to be an area that attracts capital for most public pension funds. We'll see if this increase in rates slows down that a little bit. I think it's going to make all forward-looking returns better. Just, you know, equities start at a better price. You get more from fixed income that you used to get for many, many years now. So from that perspective, with the assumptions having come down for many investors, there may be less of a need to take extra risk. That said, it's probably sexier and more appealing for most people that ultimately make decisions to look at private equity than it is to look at, you know, core equity or core bonds if it is passive. So I think it will continue, and where, you know, private credit, I've seen a good number of groups trying to swap liquid bonds for some type of illiquid credit where you can get a premium if they needed that to get to the returns. Hedge funds, what we do at Makita, tends to be mostly to complement bond portfolios, long duration bonds with some type of long volatility, less tail mitigation type strategies. So overall, private equity returns have been very strong. We'll see what the numbers begin to look like this year. You know, right now, those are beginning to come out. May hit a pause. Some groups that may be overextended may sell some positions. But again, those I think, would be the only ones that are kind of forced to or have made major changes to their asset allocation. Otherwise, I think it's going to continue to attract capital.
Yeah, I would submit there's really no place to hide. There's places that you can invest in that don't have great current marks in some of the alternatives, but they're, you know, when you have interest rates moving like they do, it affects everything. So, you know, unless you're fortunate enough to have oversized commodities or oil and gas, and then you have cash flow producing assets, those are always good in any environment. Any other thoughts or comments just on the market environment?
I've just seen that, I mean, a lot of the private equity got marked up a lot last year, I mean, substantially. And then the lag in the marking down and the public markets going down, most people are way over their targets. So I think that's why CalPERS is looking to possibly try to get back down to their targets at this stage. But I think other people are pretty much staying the course, and just holding it and figuring public markets will come back, and then they'll get back in line with their allocations.
Gilbert, this is a good segue to you and the committee.
On the Investment Advisory Committee, we met. The attendance was strong, and, of course, we reviewed the portfolio as a matter of course. But we happened to have a manager search, I think Ryan will go through the details. Both good managers. They were close. I do want to comment that, you know, there was an effort made on, you know, looking at diverse managers. They just didn't make it to the final two. Part of that reason is it's a specialized area, right, emerging market debt, and there aren't many players. So why don't we just go right into it, Ryan?
Okay.
Two good firms. You know, you could kind of go either way. Some had positives, some negatives on whether it was the ownership structure or other things. But long story short, we went with MetLife as a recommendation to the board.
And quick question. Is this to replace Ashmore?
Yes, Ashmore's
okay,
currently
under. So we're not increasing our emerging market.
No. And Ashmore, given their underperformance, is a little bit under target right now. We're not talking about bringing them immediately up to forward. It's going to take the proceeds we get out of Ashmore once the contract's done and MetLife will be set up and redeploy that into MetLife. So Mike can talk a little bit about the process, high level, but MetLife EM debt, it's a blended product. As a reminder, we have a 4% target to EM debt, which makes it the credit bucket, 4 to high yield, 4 to bank loans, and 4 to EM debt. We expect we'd be able to fund it probably in September. They have $2.6 billion in EM blended debt, and we're looking at going into a daily liquidity CIT vehicle that's got about $600 million in the product.
You say blended, is that currency between
US so
currency and...
Mike will kind of cover that in a sec.
Okay.
So, we'll go ahead to hand it over to Mike, and he'll talk a little bit about the process, and then we can answer any other questions.
And I think on that, while they have... The track record is only, what, 6 years long or something to that effect? They've been together much longer.
15?
Yeah. Is it much longer?
18.
Yeah, because they came from another firm, so it's quite... it's just misleading. I want to make sure everybody knows that. The other thing, too, is the Met resources of people in different countries and overseas are quite significant.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mike.
Thanks. Yeah, so staff began the search process after the IAC approved the process at the March meeting. So staff started by screening the entire investment universe of EM debt managers, 441 products there.
So Mike's on page 87 for anybody on the phone.
Sorry. So we screened those 441 managers for our criteria that we established pretty early on in the process. After meeting with Makita multiple times, we arrived at 7 RFP candidates. 5 were on Makita's shortlist. 1 was not, but approved by Makita, and then the other was Ashmore, who's the incumbent. We sent out RFPs on May 23rd. They were all returned on June 6th. From there, staff interviewed 4 managers. If you go to the next slide. Staff interviewed 4 managers in mid-June, MetLife, TCW, PGIM, which is Prudential, and Payden and Regal. From there, we narrowed it down to 2, MetLife and TCW, who presented to the IAC yesterday. If you go to the next slide, 89, it's just a quick summary of how we kind of arrived at our finalists. This is the same one that we use, the same scoring sheet we used for the small cap equity searches, but we just went 20% weighted to organization, 20% to investment team, 25% to philosophy and process, 25% to performance, and 10% to fees. And that's it. We've gone into the recommendation.
Okay, and just building your question on the hard currency blended. So this is shown blue is hard currency, green is corporate, and yellowish orange is local currency. So MetLife was the truest kind of their benchmark. I think 35%, 35%, 30, about a third, a third, a third. They had the kind of truest blended allocation over time of the 4 we looked at. And then one other thing I want to point out is we're looking at potentially a performance fee with MetLife. The flat fee we propose was 55 basis points, and there's a performance fee that's a base fee of 20% of our performance on a rolling 1 year and a cap of 80. So it would require them to outperform the benchmark by about 1.75 to get to the current base fee proposal. So we like the structure. I think there's a little bit more work to do on it. We're going to look at kind of trailing returns and what we would have paid the last couple of years under the structure. But
net, if you pay more, you've gotten a bigger return.
Yeah.
I think performance fees make sense.
Yeah.
We'll try to drive that way wherever we can.
Well, yeah, we like it.
We just wanted to put some type of...
Sure.
So maybe add a peer group on top of it or something like that, just because sometimes everyone outperforms by a bunch.
Right.
Depending on the cycle. But I think they're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we also have one on Walter Scott and Global Equity, so this would be our second one. But we like the structure where there's, you know, we know kind of what they need to do to reach the kind of break even and then make sure we have a cap on the upside.
Yep. That makes sense.
These firms don't hedge, right? So you're getting true foreign currency exposure, or are they?
Mike, I mean, they use a little bit of.
So we use non-deliverable forwards to hedge currency.
They're usually very expensive to hedge in these emerging markets.
But your other chart showed that some of these bonds are in U.S. dollars, too.
Yeah.
The dollar denominated, so it's a combination of foreign currency and U.S. dollar bonds.
So they'll invest in U.S. like dollar bonds, local bonds, and then the corporate bonds. And then if they see, like, in a certain country, they like the interest, they like the bonds, but they don't like the kind of currency status of their relative to the dollar, they'll hedge that out. So it gives them the option to invest in.
Surprising, MetLife has done as well as they have, given their foreign currency holdings.
Well, yeah, I mean, we looked at, like,
been very strong.
Yeah, Payton and TCW perform well, too, but they have the tailwind of being a higher allocation to U.S. dollar currency. We added some questions in the RFP around derivatives and limitations on derivatives, what type of derivatives they use, and we eliminated a few from the seven that just didn't seem to have appropriate guidelines to use CDS or, you know, uncovered shorts, that type of stuff. So I think we have a pretty good sense of kind of how they're going to use it and what the limitations would be.
Okay. And then one other question, just broadly speaking, just so I know, when we identified and talked about wanting to directly target, you know, minority-owned firms or include them in a way, what exactly are we doing? And then how is that getting weighted, and just some sense of process and proportionality?
What we're really doing is we're not targeting. It's really the other way around. We're just trying to make sure there's no inherent artificial barriers that are knocking out good managers just because they might be newer. In other words, we're looking at them holistically rather than just, well, if you don't have a $10 billion in the product, then you're out. Sometimes you can inadvertently knock out some very good firms that are smaller or minority-owned because they tend to be higher represented in smaller managers. So we're not targeting or putting our thumb on the scale. We're just trying to make sure we don't leave any out inadvertently in the process.
Is that
clear, though?
How are you doing?
Well, we're just trying to make sure that as they get the broad list, the criteria isn't stringent enough that none of them even make the 447, or none of them even make the 7.
Okay.
And then once you get to a smaller list, well, then it comes down to their philosophy, the process, and how does it all work relative to what we're trying to achieve.
And, I mean, from a staff standpoint, we pulled out a bunch of data from eVest, and one of the categories we put down is minority female ownership, and we look at that, and we have stats on, you know, how many in the universe met that criteria. We look at, you know, why they were eliminated and make sure that, like Gilbert said, you know, there's not someone that is being eliminated that is worth looking at. So we just are making sure we're aware of what's in the universe and what the ownership looks like. And then if, you know, as we're evaluating them, that organizational category here is where we, you know, how we rank them.
So the companies self-designate in those categories.
If they report.
And the ones you look at, you don't look at the composition of management.
No, the ones that we look at, we will also, like, we ask a lot of questions about the diversity of the two finalists. And, you know, frankly, it's appalling. I mean, it just is. Some have, like, zero African-American in senior positions. Zero. And these are big companies. And I just think, naturally, the more questions are asked by trustees, the more it'll be impact them as they go back and manage their businesses to do things.
What MetLife were you recommending? What's their?
Theirs is also lousy.
Theirs is lousy. They're bad as well.
They're, but they're degrees of bad. They're both bad. And we made that point clear to them, that they just need to do better. I think with TCW, you probably have some succession issues coming. There's a portfolio manager who's been there many, many years. You know, she's in her 70s, and she's fantastic, but the bottom line is, I think you've got two people, their average experience is about 35 years each with the firm, and you got succession issues. Whereas with MetLife, they've been together a significant amount of time, but they're still younger, and they have the resources of MetLife, which are very significant.
Yeah, that's true.
They have offices all over the world that they are able to turn to, you know, significant research teams. So there's pluses and minuses to both. But ultimately, it was interesting. It was unanimous, which is not always the case on MetLife. You know, Freeman, who's LCG, another fine consulting firm, you know, they use MetLife. Tom Toll had very good things to say about MetLife. So it's interesting. We all came to the same place, but from different points of view.
Okay.
So I don't know if I'm shedding more light or not.
So in your opinion, do we have a process that can be consistent? So then we have a search 6 months or a year from now that we have a way that we're approaching this that can be that's consistent.
It is. Where I'd like to get, if you know, in a perfect world, something a few people are instituting is to include a diverse firm, which has been defined in certain places, primarily in Illinois, which is the leader of diversity through legislative action, of either woman-owned, minority-owned, or disabled veteran-owned. So that's the definition. To include one in the finals in every search, meaning we would have interviewed three instead of two, and one of them would have been a diverse firm. It doesn't mean you're going to hire them, but what it does do, it gives us exposure to some firm we might not have ever seen. And it gives them exposure to a big pension fund that maybe they would not have had otherwise.
Or the process.
Yeah. And it makes Makita do a little bit more work to follow these firms because they and other large consulting firms aren't necessarily following them. And no fault to their own. I mean, it's true, right? I mean, it's
not true.
It's true. Yes, it is. And I'm happy to debate it right here in front of everybody. Yes, it's true. You
can debate it like that.
Well, I'm happy to debate it. It's true. It's true. At the end of the day, why don't you just defend why rather than argue? Because the point is there's 5,000 managers. You can't follow them all. We get it. But the point is there are a lot of minority firms and diverse firms that are not being followed by the larger consulting firms. It's just not. So by making sure that one is in the finals, it just forces the consulting firm to make sure that, well, golly, if I've got to start including one, I better really roll up my sleeve on looking at these firms to really find the best ones and to know more about them. Everybody wins. Doesn't mean we got to hire them, but everybody wins, including the diverse firm, because they go through the process, they get more exposure, and that will prepare them for the future. That's where I'd like to get.
Good. That was great.
Very
good overview.
Good. I appreciate that.
And we talked to the committee about this yesterday, too. I mean, on Global Alpha, we ran into some contracting issues on fiduciary standards, and we added more questions to the RFP about it. I don't think we're going to run into any contracting issues with MetLife, but, you know, if we did, we're totally comfortable with TCW as an option as well as a backup, but we're moving, you know, pending your approval, we're moving forward with that recommendation, and I think we'll probably be able to get to funding by September.
We need a motion to approve both the dismissal of Ashmore and the
Good point.
I mean, the board has the final responsibility for hiring and firing managers based on the recommendations
we should probably
of staff, Makita, and the IAC, but the board should be taking that action.
So the recommendation should be to terminate.
Gilbert, make a motion if it's required.
Yeah, I'll make a motion.
Fire Ashmore and hire
MetLife
as their replacement.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Well done, Gilbert.
Let me go get.
All right.
The next item, we have our ag manager, Hancock, here in person to review the portfolio.
So we're going to show that it is this statistically possible to have a private equity manager that compounds a good rate of return over a long
period
of time?
Yes, as long as you've been invested with them since 1998.
Right.
Stay there. Yeah. 132. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think.
You're right. 132.
The mayor's office. It is, like one of his.
But he just looked in the wrong place.
Julia,
Yeah.
But here's the clicker. I don't want to give too clear to give you.
Okay, so
this is the closed session clicker.
Put it over there by the theory. Well, actually,
we have two clickers. This is for closed session.
Okay.
I'll bring you the open
session.
Here, I'll bring it to you now. I might have to start going.
A lot of it, but.
My goal is you sticking around for the
oil. I had some discussion with Brian at my instructor, but depending on who's like I think
lost her quorum. But you got a couple people. Oh, no, that's true.
Definitely, he's better.
He's
very. I mean, I just like even in
okay.
Questions, you know.
Okay.
Kind of like,
yeah.
I just don't think I bring. I don't think
yeah.
I bring.
I would say yeah.
But just, I mean, even yesterday,
the
risk and the exposure of the turnover. I mean, I just I'm learning, but the question
is, you know, you think I'm from Chicago, I might be
I don't even know if I'm reappointed.
Yes, sir.
But that's a normal thing in the life.
Hard doesn't mean you
have to have a soft heart, right?
That's true. That's true.
Ready? All right.
Yes.
So we have Hancock here to talk. I'm going to call him Hancock for 3 more years for changing their name to Manulife. We already have Manulife in the portfolio. I can't handle it. So Hancock/Manulife Investment Management has managed our ag portfolio since 1998. Just a reminder to set the table. Our portfolio is currently valued at about $94 million, which is 5% allocation. We have a long-term 5% allocation to natural resources. We currently also have some timber in that portfolio, but of all the private assets we talk about, this is one of the portfolios that we intend to keep long-term. Portfolio has performed very well since inception with an IRR around 15 and a total value to pay it in about 3.7. So, we right-sized this portfolio over the last 5 years. I think it was up to like 160-ish million. We sold a bunch of properties to bring it down to the current target. We got 71 million proceeds over the last 5 years out of the portfolio. We'll go into more on the go-forward portfolio, but it's a concentrated, permanent crop, nut, and apple property portfolio, all on the west coast of the U.S., largely in California. We're going to talk about repositioning a few of the properties due to some water issues and what the portfolio might look like longer term, but just a preview, and over to you, Stu.
Great to be here. Thank you. Thanks for having us. It's fantastic to be able to do this in person. The last 2 years, so it's great to be here in Dallas, and thank you. Ryan's hit on some of the kind of the history and the past. First comment I will make, we have actually changed our name. We were Hancock Natural Resource Group as a subsidiary of John Hancock Life Insurance. We switched our name to Manulife Investment Management, Timberland, and Agriculture, a bit of a mouthful, but that's coming in closer with our parent company, Manulife, which is a Toronto-based Canadian life insurance company, and that's kind of part of an effort to streamline all of the investment management services that Manulife provides and bring us closer to other real assets such as infrastructure, real estate, private credit, private equity, any sorts of things. So.
But there's not a structural change, right?
No structural change.
Just a name change.
Exactly. In fact, we still are a bit of an autonomous group from the rest of the real assets, as timberland and agriculture, as the two assets overlap quite nicely, and it's where our expertise lies for sure. So give me that introduction. I'll give you a bit of a – make sure I've got the right
– yeah, make sure you get that other one for now.
There we go. So TMPC, the Texas Municipal Plans Consortium, is the name of the portfolio that we manage for you on behalf of the Dallas Police and Fire Pension. And today we're just going to do a quick overview of what Manulife Investment Management, Timberland and Agriculture is. We'll speak a little bit about the broad agricultural economic environment, speak about some of the impacts and influences that are, I'm sure, impacting a lot of your investments and asset classes. And then we'll go directly into a portfolio overview and discuss where we are today and where we are headed in the future. So across the timberland and agricultural platform, we've got almost $15.5 billion worth of assets across seven nations with staff in each one. We're about $4.3 billion in agricultural assets of that 15.4, which counts to about 445,000 acres across the U.S., which 75% or 79% of our assets are, and then Canada, Australia, and a growing exposure in South America, specifically in Chile. We have impressive returns since inception in 1995, and noting that TMPC is one of our oldest portfolios, put together in 1998. In fact, the portfolio hand here has returned better than the overall platform, showing some strong active management of the portfolio, but also I would just like to point out that it's the long-term hold and the patient capital in agriculture that creates great returns. So the fact that TMPC has been around for 24 years is a big aspect of why it's been strong returning for the pension. I want to talk a little bit about the current economic environment. Obviously, inflation is on top of everyone's mind. Interest rate increases and how that relates directly to farmland is an important aspect. We want to focus on where this portfolio is focused, which is specifically tree nuts in the western portion of the U.S., and how those have impacts. So currently, right now, we're seeing some interesting challenges on both almonds and pistachios, which make up about 90% of the exposure in the portfolio. Almonds continuously have large production. The U.S. is about 80% of global production of almonds and dominates the export market. So it puts us in an advantage perspective in terms of not being a price taker and really managing the global market. However, we've seen large expansion of acreage over the last many years and record crops over the last 2 years. So that, combined with some supply chain issues that we're all familiar with, have created a bit of an overhang of stocks and softened prices in the past. We still have strong production levels in the future, but what we're seeing, and we'll get into this a little bit later, is significant water risk and drought situations in California. We're seeing older orchards retiring out of production. So we do see support for prices in the near term and the longer term. However, it's not without challenges due to the physical water restrictions that are existing.
You said the U.S. is 80%. Is Portugal a major producer of almonds?
Not a huge, but growing. Portugal and Spain both do tree nuts as well. However, they have more of a focus on the olives than both almonds.
With all the sort of protein diet, is demand gone up for pistachios and almonds?
It has. It continues to grow a stronger profile on the pistachio side than the almonds side at the current time. It's an interesting situation to talk about, and I want to get into this a bit about inflation. So farmland perspective has been often thought of as an inflation protection, and we look at that more in the row crop perspective. And seeing that this portfolio is exposed to the permanent tree nut, it's a different influence, and inflation doesn't have as big as an impact. It's more human consumption and dietary trends that have a huge consumption or a huge impact on demand for almonds. If you think about it, corn, for example, is only 10-15% human consumed, where almonds is 100% human consumed. So it really is a matter of what the trends are in the diet across the globe. Almonds have been expanding their product base over the last kind of decade into almond milk, other sorts of protein replacements. So huge encouragement there. Where we're seeing pistachio demand growing is a lot in ingredients now, not just from a snack food, where it was traditionally, but we're now seeing it in ice cream and all sorts of other different aspects. So we're seeing strong growth.
We switched our emphasis to these two aspects.
Yeah, so when we did
it was based on cash return. Can you remind us?
So when we did the wholesale in 2016, it was still more tilted towards the permanent nut properties. We had some stuff in Australia, and then we had some row crops. Pretty much sold all the row crops. We sold the vineyards that we had, you know, that came not through their portfolio, but through the other investments. And we focused more on the properties we have now. By intention.
What was the thinking? Was
it? It was a higher income component,
okay.
A higher return, a more concentrated, and a much higher income component.
Okay, that's what I recall. Has any of that changed, I guess?
Pardon me, sir?
Has any of that changed?
Yeah, going forward, yes. We've got some ideas in terms of where we want to focus, and not so much on a global scale, but specifically water risk and concentration risk.
I just have a quick question. You said that you're 80% of the global production of almonds. Couldn't you mitigate soft pricing because of that?
Yes, it, to a certain level. Certain demand influences are uncontrollable on our side, and the issue that we've got is a high supply at the moment and supply overhang. We also see
storage.
Storage is full at the moment in the American storage, and unfortunately not so much as a lack of demand, but a challenge in the supply chain and actual movement of almonds. So that's the big issue. We are also seeing increased competition out of the Australian market, expanded acres of almonds throughout Australia, and that will continue in terms of what we see in the U.S.
And then just to understand, for this account, do we own the land, or are these just long-term leases, right to farm?
Great question. So it's all fully deeded land that you own and have owned outright since 1998, most of these properties, or within that late 80s or late 90s, early 2000s acquisition time period. So we've got really high cash flowing profiles for these properties based on the fact that the costs are minimal, but redevelopment comes up periodically on each of these properties, which is where we want to concentrate our go-forward plan based on the cost of redevelopment and availability of water.
And are we the 100% owner? Or this
you are the 100% owner.
Okay.
You just answered my question.
So we're the 100% owner, and talk to me like I'm stupid. What actually is the asset that we own the property? You guys actually, what are we getting for this? Because I'm not very familiar with owning this type of asset.
Very fair. Great question, actually. So permanent crops, very different than row crops. You've got two real asset drivers. You've got the dirt, and you've got the biological asset, the trees themselves. So you own both. And through that, you've got two value return or return streams, the appreciation of the land and the cash income off the trees that are produced on an annual basis. We are seeing challenges in appreciation right now because of water risk, and we'll get into that a little later in the presentation in terms of the way we review and look at each individual property. But one thing that I do want to pinpoint on specifically this portfolio is high productive trees. You yield consistently above the state average. You've got very efficient farms with low-cost operations, which have created great, strong cash flows. We have much stronger cash flowing profile on the permanent direct operates than we do on the row crops, and that's why back in 2015 there was a rebalancing to focus on the directly operated permanent crops.
This final question, is it typical for these types of investments for a fund like the pension fund to be the 100% owner? Why is it as opposed to it being a more diversified ownership structure?
Great question. And we actually manage a variety of different structures that include separate managed accounts, which we would classify this as, where one entity is the 100% owner and has a diversified portfolio. And those can range in size from as small as $25 million up to $500 million. Obviously, diversification is subject to the size and the amount of capital we have. We also have commingled funds, which share a limited partnership structure, so we can have significantly more consolidated capital and more diversification. We have small club deals where we can put two or three institutions together in order to achieve a certain amount of diversification or exposure that they're looking for. It's really a matter of what are the aspects that the institution is looking for to get out of an agricultural exposure. That's what we work directly with Ryan and Mike to make sure that we're matching the profile of what you need out of this investment. And
well, I'll just say I think this is a great investment, but the only reason I asked the question about whether this is like a 100% wholly owned product asset by the pension fund is that I think of some of those other assets that we had where we were the sole holder and it doesn't have that same result, but I'm just curious as to whether that is a kind of ordinary course thing that you see in pension funds. Are is this another thing where we are the sole holder of an asset, this one doing well, but we've had others where it hasn't been doing well?
So, Mark, I would say, like, for a pension our size, if we were building a 5% allocation to ag from the ground up, we would probably lean more towards, like, a co-mingled fund,
yes,
more diversification. But we like the portfolio we have right now. We like, you know, the manager we've worked with. It performed well, so... And maybe, and we're probably on the smaller side for a separate account mandate. So it's a little bit unique in the history and how long we've had it. And, you know, similar to real estate, once we build that back out, we're probably not buying direct properties. We're probably looking more at fund structures. And that's one of the things we've also talked to Stu about is just as this portfolio evolves over time, you know, and we sell properties, should we look at individual properties or should we look at getting more diversified and investing in a fund type structure. So that's a discussion we that's been ongoing.
And we'll touch on it a little bit later in the presentation because I think some of the things we're going to show you here today will be of interest to you for that for sure. So I want to, in the interest of time, keep moving here from an economic situation or an economic macro outlook. Basically what we're saying on both the almonds and the pistachios is there have been a bit of headwind in terms of supply and soft pricing. However, we see some positive tailwinds in the future with being water restrictions and acreage coming back off of that. So we should see lower production levels in the future. I will point out, though, there is high drought risk and a serious drought situation that we're looking at the moment. This portfolio, even though we have specific concern, is in a great situation this year, and we are looking at a great harvest coming this fall, starting in late August. So we have all the water we need to continue to farm, but we're not guaranteeing that in the future. So that's the problem we're looking to solve. One aspect I want to touch on is farmland and inflation. As I said, farmland has often been touted as a great inflation protection. We're now looking at not record high, but 40-year highs of inflation levels in the U.S. So obviously we want to see if we're well prepared for that situation going forward. In a bit of a historical analysis, we do see high correlation between inflation rates and farmland values pre-Great Recession, so pre-2008. You can see above that 20% a level of correlation. Post 2008, that correlation breaks down and actually goes negative, and that is based on continued appreciation for farmland assets in the U.S. while inflation remained very stagnant throughout the last 14 years, or 13 years or so. This is because we see a different set of parameters focusing and influencing on values that are often driven by diet and consumer preferences, as well as a complete new paradigm shift in technology and efficiencies on farms. So the advent of precision agriculture and the ability for farmers to produce more income out of each acre of land, therefore raising the value of that acre. So an interesting new paradigm shift that we've been in the last 13 years. So with that being said, as we move into a higher inflation environment now, we don't have the same confidence that we'll be fully hedged with these assets as we would have in the past, as well as rates. Interest rates are an interesting impact. Obviously, debt financing is a large portion of foreign operations across the board, but I will note that unlike the 80s, when we saw high debt levels of farmers and subsequently high rates and numerous amounts of bankruptcies, we're not in the same situation as we are now. As we've seen,
since the Great Recession. We've had strong commodity prices, strong returns for farmers. Farmers are at a very advantageous debt servicing level across the U.S. We're very confident that farmers are able to consistently make it through in a higher rates situation. Two reasons why I would say that: A, obviously they're not nearly as levered, and second, debt options for agriculture are significantly more advantageous than general rates that we see through federal subsidies, as well as credit union and agricultural focused debt lending institutions have much more competitive rates than you would see in general. Other
do we have any debt on these properties?
We do, and we'll discuss that a little bit later.
Okay.
Do we hire the managers of the farms actually, or?
So MIMTA is fully integrated. We have direct ownership of the management right down to the farm level. So the way we're structured is headquartered in Boston with the investment team there, and then regional farmland managers in each area. We have specific farmland managers in the regions in California and Washington, and then they have their regional managers and then individual ranch managers, we would call them. So all work for the same company and right down to the basis. On a third-party basis, we would hire consultant agronomists and certain experts in irrigation or other areas where we want to ensure that we're maximizing expertise. But to say we're
no third-party managers.
No. Okay. We do in some other of our platforms for other crops that we find more specifically best managed by others. Wine grapes are one of them. But for tree nuts, actually, MIMTA is one of the largest growers of almonds and pistachios in California and one of the lowest cost operators. And that's through 30 years of experience and building that team and expertise. So what I'd like to do is hand it over to my colleague Mitchell, introduce himself, and I'll give you a little bit of history of the, the portfolio first. So just starting back in 1998, we've had a total contributions of I believe it is $76 million over the 30-year history or 24-year history, and distributions of over 167, including all of our sale distributions that were made since 2015. So we hit a peak AUM of about $160 million, as Ryan already pointed out, back in 2015 before selling off most of the row crop assets and focusing them the portfolio on the high-yielding, high-cash-flowing permanent crops on the west. And now we're seeing the regrowth of that AUM as appreciation continues to encourage our assets. So I'll hand it over to Mitchell to kind of walk us through the portfolio at a high level and some of the returns.
Yeah, thanks, Stu. I appreciate it. So just a brief introduction. Mitchell Sandoval, I've been with the company for about 7 months now. I came over from Bank of America. I graduated university in 2020. But just to give a brief overview of the TMPC portfolio, it consists of 8 properties with a market value of just over $87 million spread across 2 regions, that being the Pacific West and the Pacific Northwest. In the Pacific West, we have 7 properties. Those are just growing pistachios and almonds, with pistachios making up the majority of the portfolio, just over 50%. And then the almonds making up about 40%. And then the next region, the Pacific Northwest, that's one property located in Washington State, which makes the remaining 10%, which is apples. We are pleased with how the portfolio has performed, but given the current high concentration and some current market developments, we are seeking to rebalance the portfolio, starting with trimming some of our exposure to South Central California. So just to dive into some of the specific factors that have really driven performance for the portfolio over the past year or so, you know, as Stu said, we are in a very severe drought in California, so that really has muted our appreciation for the majority of our properties there. And then on the income side of things, that's more of a function of a couple of factors. The first is the back-to-back record crops, which is fairly unprecedented just because almonds and pistachios are an alternate bearing crop, so it means that 1 year could have a very high yield, and then the next year its yield could be even down, say, 50%.
That's specifically on pistachios.
Pistachios, excuse me, thank you. And so we had 2 back-to-back record crops, And that combined with the supply chain bottlenecks has really left a lot of our crop in storage at the ports and really softened pricing. Now, on top of that, the inflationary pressures have really taken a little bit of a cut out of the bottom line. But although not everything is bad, California tree nut acreage has been slowing in growth over the past 2 years or so. So we expect this to provide some floor for pricing, crop pricing and land pricing. But looking forward, the first thing for the next year is mitigating some frost damage. So we had a late spring frost event in Northern California and in Washington State during our bloom. So that does have the potential to damage some of the crop, although our farm managers are very active and have mitigated this early, and we are confident that the crop will remain on budget for the year.
Not a huge concern, to be honest, for us at this point. There was earlier concerns in the season for Grant 45 or 4651, for the Apple property. However, I was in Washington myself just 3 weeks ago, and the crop has really recovered and come back and looking towards a very positive harvest, which is really, really important. And then in California, most of the TMPC properties are further south than where we saw the frost damage. So it's not a huge concern, but something we wanted to mention and just to kind of pinpoint some of the challenges we manage on an annual basis.
Yeah. Yeah, Stu, I can pass it right back over to you for some water updates.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about California water, and we'll get more into detail on this. But as you can see from this map, it is not a pretty-looking situation in California. And in the Central Valley is where the most exceptional, what they call drought conditions are, and it's continuously challenging. We, as a general rule, look to make sure that properties have two sources of water in California, groundwater and surface water. Currently, surface water, from a state perspective, is only at 5% of entitlement allocation. So that means if you – that's a state average. Some jurisdictions are getting up to 75, 80% of their entitlements. Some are getting absolutely zero. The federal water allocation is zero. So it is really where your property is located, which water district, and what sort of water rights are tied to it, that surface water is available, and the quality of that water. Not all water is created the same, so that's a really big important part is how good is the water and how well will it work with the trees or the crop that we're working on. The second is groundwater. Obviously, groundwater is a big issue. Massive pumping has been going on in California for a century. In 2014, the state brought in SGMA, which is the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which mandates that the entire state be cut up into what we're calling GSAs, Groundwater Sustainable Agencies. They were responsible to put together a GSP, which is a groundwater sustainable plan, submit it to the state for approval, I suppose, and moving forward on how to hit a sustainable yield of groundwater usage by 2040. The drought conditions right now are moving that date up earlier. The state's now asking a lot of these GSAs to contribute and submit earlier. They are in the midst of now resubmitting plans that were pushed back to them earlier this year, and a lot of those pushbacks were to get a lot of these GSAs that neighbor each other to cooperate because, you know, can't do it in a silo by any means. All this to say is that SGMA is still an evolving situation, and there is no clear path forward, and we cannot be 100% confident on what's going to happen in each GSA, what availability of groundwater we will have. So it's a moving target that we as a team manage very actively. We have a full water team with individuals based throughout Western U.S., actually. In fact, the leader lives in Oregon, and we have five different individuals throughout California who are very active in individual GSAs, active in discussions with the GSAs, and active in terms of figuring out and finding out where our biggest risks are and what we can do to mitigate that. We'll get into that a little bit more in detail. Just going to touch on portfolio performance here before we move into a closed session.
Yeah, so just looking at returns on the three-year mark, roughly about when we reconstructed this portfolio to a more permanent crop focus. So when benchmarked to other directly operated permanent crops within the United States, the portfolio is performing in line and even outperforming the benchmark itself. So on the one-year mark, we're outperforming by roughly 30 basis points. That's due to a 1.6% income return and then the 1.1% appreciation return. So Income returns are fairly muted for the year, although they are faring well than other properties within the benchmark. And then I do just want to note on the long end, the portfolio has outperformed the benchmark by roughly 540 basis points. So now that is primarily because of income. The portfolio has a very high weight in pistachios, and the pistachios have really, really driven the income because the yields on the properties have been exceptional.
Yeah, I would point out, so as you look through the deck, there might be some differing NCREIF numbers, and the reason why is because the portfolio was a significantly different composition pre-2018, where in which we included row crops. This is a snapshot of since we've disposed of all the row crops, and this is now just a permanent crop comparison of the benchmark, and why the TMPC portfolio specifically is outperforming quite substantially is the length and age of these properties and all the aforementioned competitive advantages that we've got. We're not 100% secure that this will be the path going forward in terms of water risk, so that's why we want to switch to a bit of a closed session now and discuss kind of where we want to go from here.
Okay. Let's transition over to close.
Okay.